In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a little bit about the aims of some of the most important organizations in the civil rights movement, going right back to the period of the New Deal. Organizations like the Urban League, the NAACP, also some that are a little bit more contemporary, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and CORE, even the Children's Defense Fund and the National Welfare Rights Organization. When people think about the history of the civil rights movement, they rightly think and concentrate on the effort to end segregation and racial discrimination. And certainly those have been important themes and very important projects for people involved in the civil rights movement. However, there has been another equally important side to this that suggests that civil rights organizations have always had a dual agenda. They've had a couple of things in mind, one of them being dealing with racial discrimination, but the other being economic opportunity, and not just for African Americans, but for all Americans. This morning we have as our guests two scholars who have written on this very topic, and in fact, they are the authors of a book titled The Dual Agenda. The subtitle is The African-American Struggle for Civil and Economic Equality, Donna Cooper Hamilton and Charles Hamilton. They are visiting here, the campus, and will be giving a talk on this subject in the MillerCom series. Their visit is sponsored by a number of units on the campus, the Miller Committee among them, but also Afro-American Studies and Research and the School of Social Work and a number of other departments. They will be speaking on the campus tonight at 7:30 in the Levis Faculty Center. And as is the case with these programs, they are open to the public. They are free. Anybody who is interested in attending can do that. Let me tell you just a bit more about them. Donna Hamilton is Associate Professor of Social Work at Herbert Lehman College of the City University of New York and has done quite a bit of research on issues of race and social welfare, also published a number of articles on that subject. Charles Hamilton is Professor of Government at Columbia University and is the author of several books, including one about Adam Clayton Powell, Adam Clayton Powell Jr., and also one about Black Power in America. That's the title, which he co-authored along with Stokely Carmichael, the title of the book, Black Power, The Politics of Liberation in America. Their book, The Dual Agenda, is published by the Columbia University Press and should certainly still be available if you are interested in taking a look at it. The book came out this summer, and we discussed it with them in August, and we're very pleased that they could spend some time talking with us this morning about the same subject and perhaps get into some different areas. Just to get our conversation started off, I just would want to read a very brief comment about the book, The Dual Agenda, from Hugh Price, who is president of the National Urban League. His comment on the book is that it documents that, contrary to popular misconception, the civil rights agenda is an American agenda, not an African-American agenda. Organizations like the National Urban League and the NAACP have, throughout their history, labored to persuade this nation to live up to the edict in our Constitution that all men are created equal and to honor the preamble which calls upon government to promote the general welfare. As we talk, questions are welcome. We ask only that people try to be brief, simply so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible. But everybody's welcome to join the conversation. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Let me begin with a very basic question about why is it that when one thinks about the issue of civil rights and the activities of organizations like these that we have mentioned, some of them have been working on these issues for a long time. They have a very long history. That really your thoughts do indeed go to the issues of segregation and discrimination, and that there has not been very much influence or emphasis placed on this other part of the agenda. It just has not seemed to have gotten very much attention, and I think that's what's behind your producing this book, wanting to say that it is important. But why so little emphasis on this aspect of the whole thing?
One, because the civil rights agenda, the agenda against segregation and discrimination, was such a prominent one over so many years. And indeed, the organization spent a substantial amount of their resources and attention to that in the courts, in Congress, and they were very successful in many ways. And so then they were constantly raising issues of racial segregation and discrimination. The marches, the mass marches were held, the Supreme Court cases that were won were all part of this first agenda, the civil rights agenda. The second one, the emphasis on social welfare policies, was less well known because they were less, first of all, less successful in achieving what they sought. And secondly, people, it's very hard to, how shall I say, very hard to believe that such an or such organizations could have more universal appeal.
Because they were seen as African-American organizations.
That's right. That's right. Yes. And that's basically the reason. And so we wanted to, we did this research and wanted to write this book to indicate their wider appeal, and substantially also because the economic dimension is very much in the forefront today. People are saying, well, and in fact, they've been accused of not speaking to these issues, you mm-hmm. see, and ignoring these in place of race-specific issues. And we're saying, no, no, no. And here's 60 years of history to show what positions they've taken.
Did all along people, you know, leaders of these organizations use the kind of language that you see in this quote that I mentioned from Mr. Price, where he puts it very well and very strongly when he talks about the civil rights agenda being an American agenda, not just an African American agenda. In the rhetoric, in the way that these organizations talked about what they were all about, did they really make an effort to say it like that? And have we sort of forgotten that, or was there a point where that kind, that just no one seemed to be hearing that, and that kind of way of talking about what they were doing tended to sort of fade away?
Yeah, I think it was that no one heard it, because they were seen as black organizations, and therefore the assumption was that they were concerned only about issues that were related to the black population. But they frequently made statements like, for all the poor, mm-hmm. because, of course, the black population made up a large proportion of the poor population in the country, so that when they talked about social welfare policies, when they advocated for certain social welfare policies, they were not just thinking of black Americans, but they were thinking of all Americans, and they were particularly concerned about the poor, and that was one reason why they were very in favor of universal benefits mm-hmm. as opposed to selected benefits, because universal benefits meant that just that everybody would be eligible for them.
In fact, in the health care debate for universal health insurance in the mid to late 40s, Dr. Montague Cobb, speaking for the NAACP, made the statement. I was just writing it down here while you were in one of his testimonies before a congressional committee. Health care is not a black race issue, but an American issue. In other words, what is good for, in other words, universal health care will benefit blacks, of course, but be careful. I mean, be sure to mention that it would, it was for all Americans. Same when they argued for full employment in 1940s. We're not talking, Walter White said, for employment just for blacks. No, we mean, seriously, full employment. So they made the issue, they made the points, but it's very difficult to be heard under those kinds of circumstances.
And I suppose you also have to acknowledge, as you do in the book, that that for substantial part of their history, these organizations were operating in an atmosphere where segregation was legal. It was de jure.
It was constitutional.
And for that reason, that perhaps becomes a primary part of the struggle, but I'm certain that that also makes it more difficult to make a broader sort of argument or to form coalitions with other kinds of organizations that might have similar aims. Yet here we have this really basic sort of wall that exists between people that, as you say, is a matter of law.
Yes, because it wasn't until the 1960s that that was changed. Segregation was legal.
And you made another point there that I think that your listeners should be informed about. They really did, these organizations, try to form coalitions, and to some extent were successful with labor unions, with religious groups, other liberal groups, and so forth. But because of the politics of the situation, particularly earlier, those are very tenuous relationships. And even Mr. Roosevelt in the New Deal was wary about raising certain race issues because he knew he needed the South and the Southern Democrats, and they were segregationists. So this was always a very touchy political policy question.
Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might just have tuned in the last little bit here. We're speaking with Charles and Donna Hamilton. Charles Hamilton is professor of government at Columbia University. Donna Hamilton, professor of social work at the City University of New York. We're talking about civil rights and economic opportunity in America, and the fact that civil rights organizations, going back a long way, indeed had two main sort of agendas. One certainly being dealing with discrimination and segregation, but the other, equality of economic opportunity. And this is something that they have written about in their book, The Dual Agenda, published by Columbia University Press. And also they'll be speaking on this subject on the U of I campus tonight, 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, you, the main thrust, one of the central ideas of the book is that there were three things that were very important to these organizations and continue to be important today, have been important all the way along. The fact that they stressed the need for jobs, that there has to be economic opportunity, that they need to be jobs that are in the regular labor market and they're covered by the social insurance programs that exist, like Social Security. And the third point, that the federal government should really oversee social programs. Let's go to the first point first, or perhaps for the first couple of points. It's not just enough to talk about jobs. We talk about this, the fact that we have a two-tier kind of economy developing early on, and that perhaps the main difference is between those people who are covered by Social Security and those people who weren't. And that provided some kind of safety net for some people so that there was something that they could fall back on. And not only that, it was something that we thought was basically okay. But that for other people, they had – what they had to fall back on was much less, and it was somehow much more stigmatizing.
Well, when the 1935 Social Security Act was enacted, it did create a two-tier system. The first system and the preferred system, of course, was social insurance and unemployment compensation. The second tier was public assistance for children, which in the form of ADC then, for the elderly and for the blind. In order to be eligible for first-tier benefits, you had to have a job in an occupation that was covered by what we now call Social Security and unemployment compensation. And so they recognized that this was the preferred tier, because if you were in the second tier, as you said, it was stigmatized. People were looked down upon. They were politically vulnerable, as we can see from every time there's a Welfare Reform Act, putting the word reform in quotes, of course, how vulnerable, how this particular population's attacks and the assumptions that people have about them. So they always advocated for jobs, real jobs, in the first tier. Obviously, they felt that was very important. They felt that if people had to rely on public assistance, and particularly if a large proportion of the black population had to rely on public assistance, and that would really stigmatize the entire race because the population would tend to see the whole black population as lazy, unwilling to work, hoping to rely on the dole, and so on.
Mm-hmm. In fact, when one of the NAACP people testified against this two-tier system, he specifically stated, Charles Houston, he specifically stated that public welfare, now listen to the language, it sounds very similar to what we hear today, is a dole, and it creates dependency. They knew that, you see, and they did not want people relegated to the second tier, which was public assistance.
Yeah, I think the other thing, too, when the act was passed, it excluded a large proportion of the black working population because it did not include agricultural and domestic workers. So here you have people that were actually working, and when they were unable to work due to illness, old age, involuntary unemployment, they would have to rely on public assistance as opposed to being able to rely on unemployment compensation or social insurance. So even though they had worked hard all their lives, they are still seen as people who really didn't want to, weren't able to take care of themselves, who didn't work.
And the reason that they were excluded was so Franklin Roosevelt could get the support of Southern Democrats in the Congress for his programs of the New Deal. And yes, they wanted those people excluded, perhaps for some number of reasons. Maybe that's not all about racism, but certainly that had to have played some part.
It was certainly a great part, yes.
And keep in mind, the civil rights organizations campaigned for a decade and a half to get agricultural workers and domestic workers, not just black, but all agricultural and domestic workers included in under social insurance. And that was a major struggle throughout the 30s, 40s, and into the early 50s. Mm.
You talk about the fact that these organizations really stressed the need for good jobs, not make work jobs, not something that the government would invent, that they wanted people to be in the regular labor market. How did they think about where those jobs would come from? And did they indeed think that there was some role for the government there, or were they really thinking about the private sector providing those jobs?
Well, they certainly preferred that the private sector provide the jobs. But they were so concerned about people being able to work and support themselves that they certainly were in favor of the public sector providing the jobs when the private sector was not able to do so. So they came out very strongly for full employment legislation during the 40s and then again during the 70s because they recognized that at least they had a strong belief that the private sector was really not able to provide jobs for everybody who was willing and able to work, and therefore there was a need for some sort of government program that would kick in from time to time when the economy was not doing well.
Yeah. Employer of last resort, they accepted that role for the federal government, but always the federal government should be there to fill that gap where the market could not perform. They were unequivocally clear on that position. They were very clear.
Nowadays, there's been a lot of discussion about welfare reform, but of course, as we know, there are a lot of things the government does that might be considered welfare. And in this conversation, the focus was really only on one, basically on one thing. That is this program that used to be called Aid to Families with Dependent Children,
yes,
and was swept away by the welfare reform legislation. Interestingly enough, people know the history about this. The program came about, what came to be called Aid to Families with Dependent Children, came about at the same time the Social Security was created. And at the time, it was a very small program, and it was aimed at providing assistance to widows. And the idea was, we want to make it possible for these women to stay at home with their children. Of course, now we say, no, you're not supposed to stay at home with your children. You're supposed to go out and work. So we've completely turned around on how we think about that sort of subject. Was single women with children particularly an issue at the time? And did the organizations that were around at the time think about that particular issue? And did they think, well, it was indeed good to provide some kind of support so women could stay at home with their children?
Well, oddly enough, the civil rights organizations really didn't pay that much attention to the public assistance aspects of the bill. They were so intent on trying to get universal coverage for social insurance and unemployment compensation. So it really wasn't until later when they began to be more concerned about it. Of course, they had warned that if you didn't provide jobs, then you were going to create this very dependent population. But it wasn't until later when it started out as ADC, then it became AFDC, and then AFD, you know, that public assistance for children has changed a lot. But it wasn't until later when the program was very different from what it had been thought to be when the bill was passed, because they had, as you pointed out, they had seen it as help for what they would call deserving families. Deserving families meaning widows or maybe a person, the wage earner was ill, in other words, but of course married too. These were not programs for children born out of wedlock. So it wasn't until the 50s and the 60s when there developed this great concern, because the welfare rolls were growing so rapidly, and that's when we first began to talk about welfare reform. What can we do? But the main concern was, what's happening? How can we cut those rolls? And that's when the civil rights organizations became involved, because they had some views about what welfare reform should be that were somewhat different from the legislators.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's really interesting, though, that you make the point that that historically civil rights organizations said, you know, unless there's economic opportunity, unless there's possibility for people to have jobs that really and jobs that really enable them to support their families, we're going to have a problem. They saw it coming
from the beginning,
from the very beginning.
Yeah, and that was a warning that simply was not heeded, and it came to haunt us all now.
It still is
in the 1980s and 1990s, and they, as I say, they felt that if people are going to work, and they were never against work, you see, then just to reiterate, because it's fundamentally critical, please, whatever you do, provide them jobs with decent wages, and then child care. You know, if you're talking about single mothers going to work, child care was absolutely critical. And they've always been misunderstood as to why they objected to some of the work programs that were developed beginning in the 60s and into the 70s and now considered work fair, which we can talk about in a moment. But there were very clear reasons why they were suspicious of and rejecting of those programs, even today.
I think that one of the problems was that the general public tended to see the welfare recipients as people, as I hate to keep repeating myself, as people who really didn't want to work.
Yeah.
And the civil rights organizations kept pointing out that, yes, these people would very much like to work, but they're not able to find a job. They have really search for work, and they prefer to work. They don't want to be on welfare. But that was hard for the general public to believe. And when they talked about welfare reform, then what happened was that they came up with all kinds of punitive policies aimed at trying to assure that people would prefer work over welfare. In other words, the assumption was that you sort of had, it's the stick and carrot kind of thing, that you had to force them to work. Otherwise, they would prefer to stay on welfare. And so that in many of the policies, the policies themselves were so punitive. Well, let me give you an example. When I think it was an earlier welfare reform bill before the Family Assistance Plan under Nixon, where Whitney Young, who was then the president of the National Urban League, pointed out that why must you have this special program for child care? Because you had mentioned child care, and why must you have a special program for child care only for people on public assistance? Mm-hmm. Because he was pointing out that more and more women are working. We need a national child care policy. Why? In other words, again, he was saying, let's look at this in a universal way. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about universal child care. Let's talk about making child care available to everybody instead of creating these rather punitive programs in the way in which they were planning the child care and so on, only for welfare recipients.
Let me again introduce our guests, Donna Hamilton and Charles Hamilton. Donna Hamilton is professor of sociology and social work at the City University of New York. Charles Hamilton, professor of government at Columbia. They are the authors together of a book that examines the subject that we're talking about here this morning. Their book is titled The Dual Agenda. There was a brief time when Richard Nixon and his administration flirted with the idea of sort of a minimum guaranteed income level for Americans. And it's sort of startling now to think that a Republican president, and that Republican president in particular, would have thought this might be appropriate, and apparently that it was fairly quickly dismissed. But it's an interesting idea. I'm sure far too radical now for very many Americans to accept. At the time, what did people who worked in the area of civil rights think about that? Did they think that might have been a good idea?
They were very much in favor of it because it would take the stigma away from public assistance. It was a universal program. It would really be connected to the tax system, which, of course, there's no stigma attached. We now have the
earned income tax credit.
Yeah. I mean, no one feels stigmatized getting any taxes back as a result of that. So they were very much in favor of that, of Nixon's plan in the beginning. But as the plan proceeded through Congress, it became more and more punishing, and they began to have second thoughts about it, and at the end didn't support it at all because the policies had changed so from the original bill.
A lot of people felt that they objected to it because and on record they did object to it for this reason. The annual guaranteed annual income was so low, $1,600 or something like this. Others would say, look, accept that and then let it, we'll increase it in the future. But basically, as my colleague said, you look at the subsequent amendments to the bill, the job categories that the people were going to have to go to work and so forth, they were in a particular category.
Well, it had, I think, a lot to do with control, because they were asking mothers of very young children, and they were requiring mothers of very young children to work, and these mothers would have no choice as to what kind of child care would be provided. In other words, they would be told where to take the child. And, of course, any mother has some serious problems with that when you don't have any control over who's going to be taking care of your children. Other things like that that made them see the made them against the bill. They would not be receiving even the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. They would be working for less than minimum wage. I'm sure there's some other aspects that are not really coming to mind now, but the bill had not started out like that, but it ended up a terrible, terrible bill in terms of helping people on welfare. In other words, it was not welfare reform. It was really to save the government money, because that was, of course, the main concern with the expanding welfare rolls. So they were trying to save money. And
yeah. One last point on this. Now we know from Mr. Nixon's own tapes that and his memoirs that, as he stated, they really didn't want it. And he said, let the Democrats kill it, because we don't want it. We, quote, we cannot afford it.
But it, yeah, it's still a mystery as to how it was ever introduced
well,
in,
ask
in
Mr.
the
Monahan.
Congress.
Senator Monahan.
But for some reason, Nixon was listening to more liberal staff at that time.
Dan Monahan, who was in his office then. But
others,
yeah. And there was a big fight between him and Arthur Burns, mm-hmm. Who thought it was too expensive. But once they got it introduced and started looking at the price tag, and Nixon said, look, we can't afford this.
Then the other thing that didn't help the passage of the bill, unfortunately, was the National Welfare Rights Organization, which was the organization that really fought for passage of some sort of a guaranteed annual income, because they kept talking about the size of the grant. And they kept insisting that it was too low. And I think that a lot of other people, the more conservative elements in the population, saw that as just an interest in the dole and not in work. And I think that that's where they probably made a mistake, where they should have kept just emphasizing that we want jobs. And
real jobs with decent wage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, was there a work requirement attached to this, or was it simply a matter of...
Oh, yes. For those on welfare.
They would have to work.
Oh, yes. Because it was ending. It would have ended.
It would have ended AFDC.
Yeah.
That would end so that everyone had to go to work. And a lot of people felt that mothers shouldn't have to work unless their children were of a certain age. And they kept lowering the age limit. I've forgotten how low it became, but some people had the civil rights organizations had difficulty with that, too.
There, over a period of time and perhaps culminating in what we have now come to call welfare reform, there seemed to be this growing frustration that we seem to have some intractable problems of poverty in this country, and that in spite of everything that we tried to do, everything that the government tried to do, it just didn't work. And we got to the point where people, rather than continuing to find some sort of different solution, we simply threw up our hands and say, well, we don't know what to do about this. What we have done hasn't worked, so we're just going to stop. And then, in effect, what the federal government did, it said it passed the problem on to the states. It said, okay, here, we're going to give you some money. You do whatever you want with it. You spend that, fine. You want to spend more than that, fine. But you find where the extra money is going to come from. We don't know how to take care of the problem, so maybe you'll have a better idea. What got it to us to the point where we were so frustrated that we simply gave up, rather than trying to say, well, now, wait a minute. Can't we approach this problem in some sort of rational way? Is there no solution? So we really have to say, well, we don't know what to do, so you take it from here?
Well, I think there was a lot of concern about how much money – I mean – not that it was a great amount of money when you compare it, you know, in the whole budget, but there was this assumption that this was very expensive and that we have to cut costs. There was the assumption that we were perpetuating promiscuity, drugs, alcoholism, and I don't think anyone would say that it was a great system. I mean, the system certainly needed reform. It had not ever been seen as a permanent program. It was always supposed to be a temporary program until people could get on their feet, get a job, and it had you did have people that were on welfare for a very long period of time. It wasn't fair to those people who had to rely on welfare, and the taxpayers felt it wasn't fair to them because they were supporting people that were certainly able to work. So there had been numerous attempts to reform this system, and I guess, as you say, they finally threw up their hands, and the states went along with it because the states felt that a lot of the federal regulations were stymieing any efforts that they made to change the system. And so we had a new welfare
and then
reform.
A very politically inviting slogan came along. Work, not welfare. And translated to mean work fair, not welfare. And that just caught on.
Mm. That I'm glad we get back to this point, because just before the sort of midway through, you said we should talk about workfare and the problem with workfare. And may indeed go back to the very thing that we started talking about, that the argument for people needing jobs, first-tier jobs, jobs in the mainstream economy, and the workfare approach isn't really going to work because that's not the kind of employment that people really need.
Yes. And this is one of the most, in some ways frustrating, but in some ways interesting aspects of this. A lot of political capital has been earned out of that term workfare. In fact, people have run for office saying, I'm for workfare, not welfare. And across the board, they would get applauded. The fact is, in order to be eligible for workfare, you must be on welfare. So this is not an alternative. Workfare, in its most simplest and broadest terms, means working off one's benefits. You work a certain period of time at a minimum wage, but you don't get paid. You are working off your welfare benefits, you see. Mm-hmm. Now, so it is not a tier one job. And we got to make a point again about what kinds of work you're doing, which is very important. But it's not tier one. And I call your listeners and everyone's attention to the editorial in the New York Times a few months ago, where the big issue in New York was, the union said, we're going to unionize these workfare people. And, you know, we're going to make sure they get paid minimum wage. Well, the New York Times was against unionizing them. It says, but it would be a mistake, I'm quoting, to organize welfare workers into a union because, hear this, what they are doing does not amount to a job. They're not working in the regular labor market.
It says it right there.
It says it right there, You see. So there's something rather sad about how this has when the civil rights groups all these decades called for work, jobs, they didn't mean welfare. They meant real jobs in Tier 1. In addition, look at what the workfare people are doing in many of these places around the country. I'm not familiar with Illinois, but certainly in New York and several other places, they're performing essential functions. They're cleaning streets. They are monitoring cafeteria in schools.
I just want to interrupt. You know, when you say essential functions, they are doing nursing in the hospital, that is emptying bedpans.
Oh, sure.
Cleaning. I mean, these are not make-work jobs.
These are absolutely essential jobs. And these are workfare people who are not being paid regular wages, you see. Now, and so people say, well, they must be trained, that, you know, these welfare people must be trained. But they're working. And they're performing essential. Well, and how much training do you really need to empty bedpans?
Well, there's this belief that they have to be trained to get up in the morning and go to work.
Work habits, yeah.
They have to develop better work habits because that's one of their problems. That's why they don't have jobs. When in reality, a lot of the people on workfare, at least in New York City, have been working and were victims of what they call downsizing. And so that it wasn't they didn't have good work habits. They just didn't have a job.
They didn't have a job.
And they exhausted their unemployment insurance and ended up on welfare.
So I think we should be honest as a society in that regard, if in no other way, that workfare in many ways relieves local fiscal budgets.
We are coming to the point where we have maybe about 5-6 minutes left in our conversation, and again, I'll introduce our guests. Charles Hamilton is professor of government at Columbia University. Donna Hamilton is professor of sociology and social work, City University of New York. And their book, if you're interested in reading more on the subject, is titled The Dual Agenda. It's published by the Columbia University Press, and they'll be speaking on this topic this evening on the U of I campus as part of the MillerCom series. Questions, comments, of course, welcome, 333-WI. ILL toll free 800-222-WILL. Well, you know, given the fact that you know, we talked about civil rights organizations having really three very important things that they were interested in: employment and first-tier employment, having people participate in the regular labor market that's covered by social insurance, Social Security, and the third thing, that there really should be federal control of social programs because there is so much variability in what states are willing to do and what they're able to do. When you look at the if we say this has been the main agenda, it has to be pretty discouraging because it hasn't happened. And now, just recently, as part of welfare reform, as the responsibilities for programs have gone from the federal government to the states, that's sort of like knocking out the last piece of the agenda. As one tries to assess the success, basically, of the project of civil rights, it can't be terribly positive.
No.
No, it isn't.
But, not at all.
You know, as you're right, the pendulum is swinging in exactly the opposite direction in terms of all three of those goals. But I often remind people that they faced some pretty bleak times before on this agenda. As we said earlier, agricultural and domestic workers were excluded from Tier 1 social insurance coverage for over a decade and a half. They kept on it. And building coalitions and finally achieving that goal. So this is not the brightest time for this particular struggle. But at least they're making the record, and they've engaged in the process, and I think that's all you can ask them to do.
Hmm. And is there any altering of the agenda, thinking that perhaps it ought to be restructured given where things are?
Or? It'd be difficult to say. As long as people are out of jobs, exposed to very bad educational opportunities and so forth, it would be very difficult to see what options the civil rights groups could offer. These are people who are really at the bottom. We can say, let's not bother about them. And we could say, indeed, as we're technically prepared to say now, after 5 years, you're on your own, which to some of these groups, and certainly to many of us, that's not acceptable. Provide them adequate educational opportunities and decent-paying jobs. And don't look upon this as a handout because, again, we emphasize the civil rights organizations have been as much in favor of work as anybody else in this country. So,
Is there any – has there been any sort of – alienation from or disconnection between the people that you're talking about and between the groups that are trying to work on those issues? I mean, has there been some sense that people have become sort of disillusioned with these organizations because they look and they say, well, you know, very little has been accomplished?
Yeah, I think if I may answer this one, I think there's been some very serious, quite frankly, miscalculation of what these organizations are able to do. Hmm. They've never been that politically strong for the last 60 years. They've always had to rely on outside support, allies who agreed with them and so forth. They have been consistent in their views, but they've never been able to pull off these legislative policy victories by themselves. And so then they've been blamed, however, if you look at some poll data, for one, first of all, inaccurately not paying attention to these issues, which is absolutely wrong. And now in some poll data, they're being blamed for being ineffective in delivering jobs. They were never able to do that. They were only able to make the case for decent jobs.
Well, that perhaps we will stop as we're almost at the end of the time. To people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, we'd like to remind you once again that our guests, Donna Hamilton and Charles Hamilton, will be speaking tonight on the U of I campus. It's a MillerCom event. Anyone is welcome to attend. That's 7:30 this evening in the Levis Faculty Center, talking about the dual agenda, the African-American struggle for civil and economic equality. That is also, by the way, the title of their book. And if you would like to read it, it's published by Columbia University Press and certainly should be available. And to you both, thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting us.